Hello and welcome back to the Pinsent Masons podcast, where we try to keep you abreast of the most important developments in global business law every second Tuesday. My name's Matthew McGee, and I'm a journalist here at Pinsent Masons. And this week, we examine the issue of embodied carbon in construction and ask, how can the industry reduce its emissions and avoid future claims? And we cast an eye over plans proposed to boost Ireland's AI industry. But first, here's some business law news from around the world.
EU proposes law to bolster pharmaceutical industry resilience. UK Planning and Infrastructure Bill aims to support UK growth. And Vietnam Energy Decree creates offshore wind investment opportunity. The EU's proposed new Critical Medicines Act is a significant move in its efforts to bolster the resilience of its pharmaceutical supply chain, according to experts. The Act is designed to avoid the medicine shortages that have happened in Europe in recent years, exacerbated by global events, including the COVID-19 pandemic. These shortages have been primarily driven by manufacturing issues, supply chain vulnerabilities, and intense global competition for resources. The Act aims to tackle these problems by bolstering the EU's manufacturing capacity and ensuring a stable supply of critical medicines. It designates certain projects as strategic, providing them with easier access to funding and fast-track regulatory procedures. Arjen Rijns, life sciences and health specialist at Pinsent Masons, said this development fits in well with other recent developments aimed at promoting and improving EU manufacturing capability. The European Medicines Agency, in collaboration with national authorities, will oversee the implementation of the Act. New planning laws have been proposed by the UK government aimed at making it possible to build new homes and infrastructure more quickly. The Planning and Infrastructure Bill was introduced into the UK Parliament last week and has been heralded by the government as providing transformative reforms to get Britain building. Some of the measures focus on nationally significant infrastructure projects or NSIPs, such as large wind or solar farms, major water, road or rail projects, or significant commercial projects like gigafactories, data centres and laboratories. Planning expert Robbie Owen said that the reforms to the NSIP system are most welcome and many of them have been long requested, but none are a silver bullet. There seems little doubt that ministers will need to go much further if they are to deliver on their infrastructure commitments. A new Vietnamese government decree providing regulations for the development of large-scale offshore wind power projects will open up investment opportunities and provide greater clarity for the market, according to experts. The decree will provide incentives for offshore wind projects approved by authorities before January 2031, including exemption from maritime area use fees for the first 3 years of construction, followed by a 50% reduction for the next 12 years, and a commitment from the Vietnamese government to purchase at least 80% of eligible offshore wind projects' output for 15 years, unless buyers and sellers have other agreements in place. Energy projects expert Brian Chapman said the added detail contained in the decree will be welcomed by investors interested in the offshore wind market in Vietnam. Investors will need to move relatively quickly with respect to site surveys and general project development. The construction industry is very carbon intensive. It's responsible for a huge proportion of the world's carbon emissions, and with lots of parts of the world moving to more urbanised societies, the pace of building is not about to slacken anytime soon. There are two ways that buildings cause carbon emissions. There's operational carbon, the result of the resources needed to heat a building, to light it, to keep the lifts working, to do a new fit out. Then there's the embodied carbon, the emissions related to the creation of the building or the infrastructure in the first place. Embodied carbon could account for around half of all construction emissions, so it's clearly something that needs to be tackled. But that would involve fundamental change to almost everything about how the industry works: materials, methods, commercial and legal relationships, the lot. So is it achievable at all? London-based construction law expert Anne-Marie Feel has recently published a detailed paper about the issue for the UK's Society of Construction Law. I started by asking her to give me a sense of the scale of the problem.
It's estimated that the construction and infrastructure sector contributes anywhere between about 20 to 40% of global CO2 emissions. That's a huge contribution. It's also estimated that about half of that contribution comes from embodied carbon, primarily through the use of new materials. We've also got other problems which affect the environment. We've got water pollution, air pollution, and also issues in connection with landfill from waste. So it's a big problem. To get to the net zero, the construction industry would need to move to a fully circular economy. And by that, I mean probably a 90% reuse of materials and almost a total reduction in waste. So that requires a huge level of behavioural change.
The changes involved here are huge and fundamental, and organisations are often reluctant to make big changes without very good reason. So what will actually force this to happen? Anne-Marie says it's a range of regulatory and commercial or funding pressures which companies in the industry will simply be unable to avoid. Simply put, this will happen because funders and regulators will demand it.
It's important to think about it in terms of the forces, regulatory, corporate and financial forces. On the regulatory side, it's through local planning and permitting regimes in different locations. What we're seeing is a really comprehensive review at permitting stage of the impact of new developments. This means that we need to look at these planning and consenting conditions really carefully to see what the constraints might be and the parameters on which you've got a permissible development. On the financial side, we're seeing financing institutions wish to put their money into what I'm going to call sustainable economic activities. And there is some emerging standardization around what is considered a sustainable economic activity, particularly through some new regulation in the EU. And so this will undoubtedly affect projects which are the recipients of that funding. We've also, of course, got the promises that organizations are making on a corporate level to their investors and to their shareholders. The disclosures that they're making around what they're doing to make sure that they are a sustainable business into the future. Together, all of these forces combine, and I think what we're seeing is more what I call conditions that must be met, as opposed to a feeling that you might have got a few years ago where it felt much more voluntary.
So these changes are huge and they're inevitable. Thoughts turn then to how on earth the industry is actually going to go about it. Anne-Marie thinks we need a new way of thinking about the whole industry as one big interlinked thing with webs of codependencies. What's needed, she says, is systems thinking.
Previously, construction professionals have really been used to working in the boundaries of what we call time, cost, quality concerns. And I think we need to bring a fourth pillar into that, which is sustainability. It's widely accepted that in order to solve the problem of reducing emissions so that we can get to net zero, we need to apply a system-wide approach, apply systems thinking. Now, by systems thinking, what I mean is looking at things holistically rather than looking at individual components. So you could say that each element of construction is a cog in the wheel, but the whole wheel needs to turn in order to drive change. What all of us need to do is understand the part that the particular cog that we are influencing plays in turning that wheel. And if you don't look at it in this holistic way, and if you look at it just as a set of individual components, you risk missing all the complex interdependencies that exist across the construction ecosystem. And there's a danger that no real change will ever really transpire.
The reason this holistic approach is needed is that embodied carbon is just a much more complicated issue than operational carbon, not least because it can't actually be fixed after the fact.
Embodied carbon poses a particular set of problems for the industry. If we just compare and contrast it to operational carbon, I think this helps to illustrate the point. Operational carbon is comprised of some quite static elements in terms of heating, cooling, energy systems, and these things are much easier on the whole to measure and quantify as they're less prone to variation. On the other hand, we have embodied carbon. Embodied carbon is integrated within materials, within the processes that we use. This makes it much harder to measure and quantify. We've also got the complicating factor that embodied carbon emissions begin before at the first stages of the material production cycle, before they even make their way onto the construction site. There's also another difficulty in that embodied carbon is the result, effectively, of construction. Therefore, you can't really rectify embodied carbon by doing more construction. Now, traditionally, in the world of construction, when we see things that are non-compliant, what we like to call defects, we remedy that by fixing it, by carrying out more construction to fix the problem. That only exacerbates the issue when it comes to the environmental harm, which is caused as a result of emissions. So what we need to be focused on with embodied carbon is prevention, as opposed to trying to cure it retrospectively, which will be very difficult in most cases. With embodied carbon, we need to be really, as practitioners, quite obsessed with ensuring that we achieve prevention rather than trying to remedy it retrospectively, which really is not going to be much help at all.
All this activity and all this change will ultimately be governed by contracts, says Anne-Marie, which will need to change.
We know that contracts drive behaviours. And good contracts have the potential to drive good behaviours. This is particularly the case, perhaps, in construction, where traditionally we've had quite an adversarial culture around contracts. The construction and infrastructure industry in any location is very complex. And all of this complexity means that we have a huge variation in the way that construction contracts look, the way that they're used, the way they come to market. However, I would advocate a blueprint approach that can be used regardless of the contract form that you would use. I think you can look at three things. Firstly, you need to establish what the minimum outputs are that you must achieve as a result of the project. There's a lot of potential unintended negative consequences that could come from being too aspirational in the contractual outputs that you require. So I think finding the minimum things that you must achieve, that's a really important baseline. Secondly, you really want to incentivize the right behaviors. We're looking more at carrots sometimes than we are at sticks. How do you drive improvement? How do you encourage curiosity? How do you drive innovation? Lastly, and perhaps most importantly of all, we need to manage this and have good contract management on a contemporaneous basis, because what we're focused on here is prevention in the first place. How are we reporting in real time? What are the interventions that we're able to make under the contract? What are the forums that we have to ensure that the right discussions can take place, perhaps where things are going off track? And I think if you apply that three-pronged blueprint, you can really set yourself up for success regardless of the contract model that you're using.
Anne-Marie thinks that while it's a way off because of how long construction projects take to plan and build, embodied carbon claims will form a major part of future defects claims. So if this is to be avoided, then we need to do better now in how we plan and build. Central to that, she says, is a setting of realistic targets and incentives.
We know that contracts do drive behaviours. And perhaps quite conversely, we also know that having very unrealistic or aspirational targets do not necessarily drive behaviours. The risk that they will be ignored as being because they're considered to be unrealistic, so they potentially will be written off by stakeholders before they've even begun. We also run the risk that they could drive defensive behaviour and discourage the kind of collaboration that we need in order to really deliver on sustainability outcomes. So in an ideal world, your minimum targets would be challenging because we really do need to drive improvement, but also ultimately achievable with the right planning. What we do know is that once construction starts, you know, construction can be quite hectic. It's going to be hard to really change direction strategically at that point. You really do need a plan in place for how you're going to achieve success.
It's a rare country these days that doesn't loudly trumpet its desire to become a hub for AI excellence and investment, or some variation on those words. We reported a few weeks ago on the UK's plans to do just that. And now it's Ireland's turn. An AI advisory council has published its recommendations for the government on how it can, in the council's words, reinforce Ireland's role in the global AI ecosystem. It says Ireland has the potential to become Europe's preferred base for both startups and established companies seeking to launch or scale AI products and AI-first ventures, benefiting from Ireland's skilled workforce, research capabilities, and the existing presence of many multinational technology companies. So I asked Dublin-based technology law expert Maureen Daly what the Council's recommendations actually are.
What the AI Advisory Council has done is put forward a number and a broad range of recommendations for the Irish government to do, ranging from increasing funding for AI research and development to building an AI-focused startup system, creating guidelines for the use of generative AI in education, and even having mandatory AI literacy training at all educational levels. So it really is a broad range, and I suppose this requires the government now to go ahead and adopt a targeted and strategic investments and policies in order to kind of safeguard the Ireland's competitiveness and also the jobs as AI just continues to evolve.
The recommendations cover a lot of ground, including things like the suggestion about AI in education. But Maureen identified two areas where there were concrete proposals that businesses should be following.
They have proposed to develop an AI observatory with the aim of delivering data and insights on a wide range of AI metric, and for that to be publicly available. And I think that is a great resource because it would be of enormous benefit to the policymakers, to educators, to workers. And it helps all of them to navigate the challenges that are ahead when we're looking at AI. And with anything, having live data helps develop and take things forward. So I think that's a really important concrete proposal. Another area that they put a really concrete proposal is to establish an AI Energy Council, which in Ireland is really important because the energy deficit is something that Ireland has to urgently address. Up to now, obviously, AI, it's a huge energy consumption. Data centres are needed, but there's been a massive halt on that section because of we need to expand the capacity of our energy grid. We're too reliant on fossil fuels, so there has not been an expansion. There's been a massive halt in that side. So I think having an energy council looking at that, maybe working with public bodies to identify where are the bottlenecks, what do we need to do, how do we accelerate the expansion of the grid, how do we come up with other, maybe develop renewable energies, how do we streamline that?
Lots of advisory groups recommend lots of things to lots of governments all around the world, but that doesn't mean that things get done. So will the Irish government actually do much of what's in the report? It's not totally clear, says Maureen.
The council will work with the government. What they have done is these recommendations. They're really only a broad framework. They acknowledge themselves that they're going to further refine the recommendations throughout the year. So I suppose it's a work in progress. The ministers have said that they'll take on board the recommendations, that work with the council and then work with other colleagues and other departments to see how things can be progressed. I think it's really going to be business and the industries looking for this type of information, looking for guidance that will actually push the development coming along. I think having the AI Council there will be great because if they keep coming out with these recommendations and having public discussion on it, I think that will lead to things actually getting done.
There are real diversions on AI policy around the world, most notably on how closely development is regulated from a security and safety point of view, and to what degree companies are prepared to enable AI developers to use other people's intellectual property without permission or payment in the development and operation of AI systems and tools. So actually, there probably will be some countries that will become hubs and centres, hoovering up a disproportionate share of inward investment, jobs, people, and opportunities. So in light of the Advisory Council's report, What are Ireland's chances of becoming one of those hubs?
The fact that Stanford University in November 24 ranked us in the terms of AI vibrancy per capita ahead of countries such as the UK and Sweden and Israel, I think that's a great report to have. But it's like anything, it's trying to keep that grade, it's trying to keep that ahead of other countries. And I think this is where the issues such as our capacity on the energy front needs to be urgently addressed. Because at the current time, obviously, expansion of data centres has halted because of the issues with our grid capacity and the fact that we are so fossil fuel dependent. So the government really needs to address that issue, address the bottlenecks that exist in order to expand that capacity. If that doesn't happen, we definitely will be falling down.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you so much once again for listening, for coming back to us and spending time with us. It's enormously appreciated when there's so much out there that's clamouring for your attention. But remember, you don't have to wait every fortnight for the podcast. You can find out what's happening in the world of business law with exclusive news and analysis produced by our team of journalists and published at pincentmasons.com. And if you want a personal digest every week, you can find it at pincentmasons.com/newsletter. Just sign up there. Please do review, share, tell your friends and your colleagues and anyone who might be interested in the material we cover here. Every little bit helps. And I look forward to speaking to you again next time. Thanks and goodbye. Pincent Mason's podcast was produced and presented by Matthew McGee for international professional services firm Pincent Mason's.